Welcome to History in a Year, America's first 250 years.
Join us every single day as we journey from the Revolution of 1776 to the 250th anniversary of the United States.
You can find every episode and join the discussion at pointedwords.com. I'm Stephen.
And I'm Leah.
It is January 21st Street. Welcome to episode 21. Yesterday, we stood on the field at Yorktown in 1781. We watched the British Army stack their muskets. We heard the drums beat, the world turned upside down. It felt like the end of the movie.
But history isn't a movie. And in real life, the credits didn't roll at Yorktown. In fact, a very dangerous new chapter was just beginning.
There's a strange gap in our collective memory of the Revolution. Yorktown was October 1781. The Treaty of Paris, which officially ended the war, wasn't signed until September 1783. That is a 2-year gap.
During those 2 years, the American army didn't go home. They couldn't. The British still held New York City with thousands of troops. So George Washington took his army and camped them in Newburgh, New York, about 60 miles north of the city, just to keep watch.
And they sat there for 2 winters. And if there is one thing you never want, it is a standing army with nothing to do. They were bored, they were anxious, and most importantly, they were broke.
Congress was bankrupt. The Articles of Confederation, the government at the time, had no power to tax. They had to ask the states for money, and the states usually said no.
So the soldiers hadn't been paid in months. Some hadn't been paid in years. Their families back home were starving. Their farms were being foreclosed on.
But the officers were even angrier. Congress had promised them a pension, half pay for life, to keep them in the army during the dark days of the war. But now that peace was coming, politicians in Philadelphia were starting to backtrack. They were saying things like, well, we can't afford that, or citizen soldiers shouldn't get pensions.
The officers felt betrayed. They had frozen at Valley Forge. They had bled at Saratoga. And now the civilians were going to stiff them on the bill?
By the winter of 1782, the mood in Newburgh was toxic. The officers started meeting in secret. They started talking about justice. And when an army talks about justice, it usually means they are reaching for their swords.
This is the moment where most revolutions fail. This is the moment where the military takes over. It happened in Rome with Caesar. It happened in England with Oliver Cromwell. And it would happen later in France with Napoleon.
In May 1782, a colonel named Louis Nicola actually wrote a letter to George Washington. He essentially said, "General, this republic isn't working. Congress is a mess. We need a strong leader. We need a king."
He was offering Washington the crown.
Washington was horrified. He wrote back immediately. "Listen to this language. No occurrence in the course of the war has given me more painful sensations than your information of there being such ideas existing in the army. Banish these thoughts from your mind."
He shut Nicola down. But he couldn't stop the anger of the rest of the army.
And here is where it gets really complicated. There were politicians in Philadelphia, men like Alexander Hamilton and Robert Morris, who actually wanted the army to be angry.
It sounds crazy, but they were nationalists. They wanted a stronger central government. They thought that if the army threatened Congress, it would scare the states into finally agreeing to a federal tax.
They were playing with fire. They were basically encouraging a military coup to prove a political point. Hamilton wrote to Washington, hinting that the army might take matters into its own hands.
Washington replied to Hamilton with a stern warning. He said, "The army is a dangerous instrument to play with."
But the fuse was already lit. In March 1783, an anonymous letter started circulating through the camp at Newburgh. It was written by a young major named John Armstrong Jr.
This letter, known as the First Newburgh Address, was explosive. It told the officers, "Suspect the man who would advise to more moderation and longer forbearance." That was a direct shot at Washington.
It proposed an ultimatum. It said, "Tell Congress that if they don't pay up, the army will not disband when peace comes. Or worse, the army will march on Philadelphia and take what is owed to them at gunpoint."
This was mutiny, plain and simple. A meeting was called for March 15th, 1783, to vote on this plan.
Washington was in a terrible position. If he didn't go to the meeting, the officers would vote for the coup. If he tuned time and tried to stop them, they might ignore him, and his authority would be gone forever.
The meeting was held in a large wooden building the soldiers had built for social events. They called it the Temple of Virtue.
It was a cold Saturday. Hundreds of officers packed into the hall. The mood was grim. There was no chatting, just angry silence.
General Horatio Gates, Washington's old rival, was running the meeting. He was loving this. He thought Washington was finished.
Then, the back door opened, and George Washington walked in.
A hush fell over the room. He wasn't invited. He walked straight to the front and asked permission to speak. Gates couldn't exactly say no to the commander-in-chief.
Washington took the podium. He looked out at the faces of men he had led for 8 years. Men he loved. And they looked back at him with cold, stony eyes. For the first time, they didn't cheer him.
He took out a prepared speech. It was a good speech. He argued logically. He told them that overturning the civil government would be a crime. He said, "You would open the floodgates of civil discord and deluge our rising empire in blood."
He promised them that he would fight for their pay. He pledged his honor.
But as he read, he could feel that he was losing them. The speech was too formal. It wasn't landing. The officers were sitting there with their arms crossed, thinking about their debts and their hungry children.
Washington finished the speech. He looked up. The room was still silent. The mutiny was still on the table.
Then Washington did something unscripted. He remembered he had brought a letter from a congressman, Joseph Jones, that explained the financial problems in detail. He thought if he read it, it might prove Congress was trying.
He pulled the letter out of his pocket. But the handwriting was small and cramped. Washington squinted at it. He held it at arm's length. He couldn't read it.
You have to understand, Washington was a man who projected perfection. He was tall, athletic, invincible. He never showed weakness. Only his closest aides knew that his eyesight was failing.
He paused. The room was watching him. He reached into his pocket and pulled out a pair of spectacles.
He had just received them from Philadelphia. He had never worn them in public before.
As he fumbled to put them on, the silence in the room deepened. And then he looked up at his officers and said, quietly, "Gentlemen, you will permit me to put on my spectacles, for I have not only grown gray, but almost blind in the service of my country."
That sentence hit the room like a physical blow.
Suddenly, the anger evaporated. In an instant, they didn't see a distant general. They saw a man who had aged right alongside them, a man who had ridden in the rain, slept in the snow, and sacrificed his own health for 8 years, just like they had.
They realized that while they were worried about their pensions, he had given his eyesight for the cause.
Observers said that tears began to flow. Hardened combat veterans were openly weeping. The tension in the room just broke.
Washington sensed the shift. He barely read the letter. He folded it up, took off his glasses, and walked out of the room without another word.
As soon as he left, Henry Knox moved a motion to thank the general and affirm their loyalty to Congress. It passed unanimously. The mutiny was over.
The Newburgh conspiracy was stopped, not by a threat or a gun or a brilliant argument. It was stopped by a pair of glasses and a moment of vulnerability.
Thomas Jefferson later said, "The moderation and virtue of a single character has probably prevented this revolution from being closed, as most others have been, by a subversion of that liberty it was intended to establish."
Washington saved the Republic that day. He ensured that in the United States, the military would always be the servant of the people, not the master.
He secured the pay for his men, eventually, and the army disbanded peacefully.
But Washington had one more act to perform to seal the deal. The war was officially ending. The treaty was coming.
And everyone in the world watched to see what he would do next. Would he retire? Would he stay in power?
King George III in London famously asked the painter Benjamin West what Washington would do. West said, "They say he will return to his farm."
The king was stunned. He said if he does that, he will be the greatest man in the world.
Join us tomorrow for episode 22. The British finally leave New York. We witness the tearful farewell at France's Tavern. And we travel to Annapolis, Maryland, where George Washington walks into the State House to do the unthinkable. He gives his power back.
I'm Leah.
And I'm Stephen. You can find every episode at pointedwords.com. And this is our story.